And we want to thank everybody who has supported your community connection, KBOO Portland, because it's all about conversation, supporting democracy, being informed, getting to the truth. And all of those are things that your KBOO Portland does. Support us, listen, tell friends and family, share. And, you know, this is the beginning of the week. As you can, smile and share that smile and give a smile to somebody else. All right. Stay tuned. We have coming up at 9 o'clock the Old Mole Variety Hour with news, views, and reviews you can use.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
On the next episode of Voices for the Animals, we'll look into the case of a goat, a girl, and the rise of more compassionate and humane alternatives to 4-H agricultural programs. We'll be speaking with Danielle Hanisch, Executive Director of LEAP, Leaders for Ethics, Animals, and the Planet. It's a program that offers students the farm animal care experience and opportunities of 4-H without the selling of those animals for slaughter, which can traumatize many kids.
These kids were, you know, 14, 15, 16 years old and just realizing, like someone flipped a switch, that, oh my gosh, these animals are no different than my dogs and cats at home. And now I'm knee-deep in this program and I don't think that there's another option and I have to betray my friend who I have cared for.
We've got your goat. On the next Voices for the Animals, Friday, November 24th at 10 a.m., right here on 90.7 KBOO FM.
Another politician sitting far away. This is the battleground.
Hi, I'm Jeff Rosenberg. Tune in to the Song Circle every Friday afternoon at 1:30 p.m.
Turn their backs on the grisly scenes, traced to the privileged sons. And your death will come soon.
You never know what you'll hear next.
Hi, this is Dwight Yoakam, and you're listening to KBOO.
Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. If there's a mole in the ground, then I'd root the mountains down. Oh, wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's Giannata sunglasses. Oh, I wish there's Giannata sunglasses. If there's not a sunglasses, then I'd show you messages hiding before your very eyes.
Good morning and welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland, your volunteer-powered, member-supported, non-commercial community radio station. I'm your host today, Fran Michelle. Every week, the Old Mole digs down into the struggles of ordinary people for democratic and sustainable ways of life, supporting grassroots challenges to top-down authority, giving voice to movements that shake the foundations of an unjust society. Today, we'll be looking at some of those unequal struggles between the rich and the rest, between the plutocrats and the people, between settler colonists and indigenous groups, between, shall we say, David and Goliath. We are in the week after the National Day of Mourning, also known as Thanksgiving, and at the end of Native American Heritage Month, also known as November. We are coming to you from Wakshin, also known as Portland, Oregon, on the traditional lands of Multnomah, Wasco, Cowlitz, Kathlamet, Clackamas, Chinook, Tualatin, Kalapuya, and Mullalo peoples. Most of us on today's show are descendants of settlers. all of us everywhere can learn from people's ongoing struggles for land and freedom, from Turtle Island to Palestine and beyond. On today's Old Mole Variety Hour, Bill Resnick talks with Middle East expert David Finkel, an editor of the magazine Against the Current and an activist with Jewish Voice for Peace, about current events in Israel-Palestine. In part one of their conversation, broadcast November 13th and available on the Old Mole's website at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour, they discuss the history of Israel's taking of Palestinian land, expulsions of the people already there, and restriction of Palestinians to smaller and smaller areas, as was done in apartheid South Africa. In today's conversation, they discuss settler colonialism and cycles of resistance and repression. They consider the pressures on Netanyahu's right-wing government coalition in Israel, the United States' financial, military, and political support for the Israeli government, the international calls for a ceasefire, and the prospects for peace and a Palestinian state. Then we turn to stories of settler colonialism even closer to home. Jan Hocken talks with Cynthia Lou Coleman, Professor Emerita of Communication at Portland State University and an enrolled member of the Osage Nation, about her recent book, Environmental Clashes on Native American Land, Framing Environmental and Scientific Disputes. One of the clashes taken up in the book centers on the discovery near Kennewick, Washington in the 1990s of ancient skeletal remains, and a long-standing fight that followed over the fate of those remains. Professor Coleman tells the story of the discovery of the 9,000-year-old skeleton, dubbed Kennewick Man, and what was at stake for the tribes and for thinking about the role of ideology and politics in scientific inquiry. Finally, we turn even closer to home. Portland activist and guest mole, Alyssa Vitale, draws on her experience with local grassroots campaigns and research on the Portland Metro Chamber of Commerce to help us understand why and how that business lobbying group has tried to insert itself into the Portland teacher strike and education policy. Along the way, we'll hear some music from winners of the Native American Music Awards, the NAMIs. As always, you'll be able to find the podcast of the show and its segments on our website at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour, where you can also find a link to subscribe to our show. If you're interested in getting involved with the Mole, or if you have suggestions, comments, or questions, you can reach us via our KBOO webpage or at Old Mole Variety Hour, all one word, at gmail.com. And remember, you can support your listener-sponsored, volunteer-powered, nonprofit community radio station by clicking on the red Donate tab in the upper right corner of the webpage at kboo.fm. First up, Bill Resnick talks with David Finkel about events in the Middle East.
Hi, David Finkel. Welcome again to KBOO.
Good morning.
David Finkel is the editor of the journal Against the Current. He's also a prolific writer, hundreds of pieces on the U.S. and international politics. He specializes in U.S. imperialist machinations in the Middle East, particularly in Israel-Palestine. And David is very critical of the current Zionist project and its U.S. partner. So, David, in the last month after Hamas's savage, murderous, and senseless attack, Israel has revealed itself as just as murderous and far more lethal, having killed over 16,000 people, about 6,000 children in aerial bombardments. That's in pursuit of its long-term goal to ethnically cleanse the entire territory that before 1948 was relatively peacefully inhabited by majority Palestinian and minority Jewish populations. In part one of this interview, played a couple weeks ago, we discussed the history of dispossession of Palestinian land and driving out Palestinians or enclosing them in smaller and smaller areas resembling those in apartheid South Africa. In this part two, we discuss settler colonialism. We explore its dynamic as the settlers seek to take control of the existing population, which, of course, triggers resistance from those indigenous. So the settlers take ever harsher measures to control them. And ever harsher measures are also used by the indigenous to defend their land and ways of life. That triggered the settlers to call them terrorists as the Hamas attack and Israeli punishment grow more murderous. That cycle doesn't end well. On that note, David, tell us about Hamas, its development, and Israel, it outsmarted itself just at the beginning of the vicious cycle.
Well, in the spirit of self-promotion, I have an article in our new issue of Against the Current. I've called it Catastrophe in Israel and Palestine, Apartheid on the Road to Genocide. And I do discuss some of the historical background. This article is on our website at againstthecurrent.org. Against the Current is just one word. Againstthecurrent.org, you'll find it there. Let me say I regard Hamas as a monster or a violent nemesis that Israel did a great deal to create. In 1982, I happened to be on a delegation of some left-wing journalists to the occupied territories in Israel. We visited Beer State University, which is the major Palestinian university of the West Bank, and the students told us about all the obstacles that they had, the closures, having to climb over barriers and stone walls to get to their campus. But they also told us something very important, which is that the Israeli occupation authorities were giving free passage to Islamic militants from Gaza, goons basically, to come and attack the students at Beer Zeit, who were nationalist students, the supporters of the Palestine Liberation Organization. And that shows how long ago Israel was already deliberately encouraging the rise of Islamic fundamentalism in Palestine. And Islamic fundamentalism is not particularly indigenous Palestinian Muslims, but it was funded by Egypt, of course. It was an Egyptian branch of the Muslim Brotherhood, which crystallized into Hamas. And Israel viewed these forces as a way of breaking up the Palestinian national movement. In 2006, if we fast forward, there was actually a democratic election in Palestine, in the Palestinian occupied territories, for the Palestinian Authority, and Hamas won. Everyone was shocked by that, including Hamas. But it was understood by everybody that people didn't vote for Hamas because they liked its Islamic fundamentalist ideology or its attitudes about women or anything about that. It was a protest against the fact that Fatah, the leading force in what was the Palestinian Authority leadership in the West Bank, was hopelessly corrupt and impotent and incapable of resisting occupation or negotiating any kind of future or anything like that. So they actually, the two forces, Hamas and Fatah, understanding their respective weakness, took some initial steps towards forming a unity government. And at that point, as I cite in my piece, there was a big Vanity Fair expose on it, the United States and Israel tried to foment a coup to crush Hamas, because by that time, Fatah and what was left of the PLO were working with the Israeli occupation authorities to keep any popular resistance movement in check. The coup flopped, and Hamas wound up taking control of Gaza and purging supporters of Fatah, and Fatah took control in the West Bank and purged as much as they could the Islamist movement. So that was how Israel and the United States crushed the threat of Palestinian democracy. And Palestinian democracy was a threat to the occupation, because democracy can lead to popular mobilization, which is a threat that no armed struggle can possibly be. Israel can crush any armed struggle, even at the cost of enormous number of Palestinian lives, which they don't really care about. But a democratic popular mobilization is something that is much more difficult for them to handle. So that's the story of how Hamas wound up in control of Gaza. And then in recent years, Israel again has been allowing money from basically Qatar, more than any other country, into repair Gaza after the repeated rounds of Israeli bombings and so forth, which they call mowing the grass. Now, there is a book, if you want to read about Gaza, there is a book called Gaza, An Inquest into Its Martyrdom by Norman Finkelstein. It came out in 2018, but it's still very relevant. The other person you can look up to read about Gaza, really probably the leading economic expert on the area, is Sarah Roy. That's S-A-R-A, and her last name is Roy, R-O-Y, and you can look up her work. But Gaza has been basically strangled. Israel occupied it with settlers in 2005 and then withdrew and subjected Gaza to a brutal siege, which was even worse than the direct occupation. And that's what led to the current explosion.
Through the whole period, you read the prediction by the group of left critics of Israel in 1967 and Israel's mounting efforts to control the West Bank and every place else, and how that leads to resistance, and the resistance then leads to further attacks and jailings and murders, and the beat goes on, and we're seeing the fruits of it. My sense is that for a quite long period, we're seeing the realization of what the Jewish left predicted in 1967, that is, of the vicious circle in the West Bank and Gaza, making life a mounting misery for the unfortunate residents. Tell us a little bit about the difficulties of life under occupation in the West Bank and Israeli administration of the Gazan economy and water and all the rest of it, that they're now, in fact, trying to starve the remaining Gaza residents, now have no oil, little water coming in, and food is very, very scarce. There's going to be deaths from hunger or lack of water included in the mounting deaths from attack from the air. Give us a sense of how that vicious cycle works.
Well, it is a vicious cycle, which is built into the dynamic of the siege of Gaza. But I believe the current situation is actually driven by something, the current Israeli war is driven by something much more squalid and sordid, and that is Netanyahu's attempt to save his governing coalition, because he needs political power to save himself from prosecution and prison on corruption charges, which may be something that sounds vaguely familiar. But he's totally unpopular and despised in Israel for a number of reasons. His attempt to seize control of the judiciary and the total lack of preparation for the October 7th attack, because military units had been moved from the south of Israel into the West Bank, where they are protecting West Bank settlers who are waging pogroms and massacres and riots against Palestinian villages. So Netanyahu needs this war to preserve his governing coalition. His governing coalition includes ministers from two explicitly ethnic cleansing genocidal parties, one called Jewish Power and the other Religious Zionism. And there are ministers in the government with powerful positions of internal security. Itamar Ben-Gvir and Bezalel Smotrich are their names. Keeping that coalition together requires an essentially genocidal policy, because coalition and therefore Netanyahu's grip on power are held hostage by these extreme racist genocidists. There's no other word for it. So therefore, in order to preserve his coalition, and especially in view of the shocking, traumatizing murder of over 1,000 Israelis on October 7th, the war, Israel's war in Gaza, is literally genocidal. Genocide is not a word I use for purposes of, you know, analogy or something like that. I think it means the planned destruction of a people, and this is the nature of Israel's war. As I say, driven partly by a certain kind of ethnic cleansing logic that has been always there in the Zionist movement, but I think is propelled right now by the state of Israeli politics, and also the guarantee of support it gets from wide segments of the American political system, particularly the evangelical Christians, who see this all as a fulfillment of biblical prophecy.
This is Bill Resnick talking to David Finkel, the editor of the magazine Against the Current. He's written hundreds of articles on the Middle East, especially the Israeli-Palestinian struggle. We've been discussing the vicious cycle of oppressor and oppressed. Also, it's a vicious escalation, and how it's been driven by the ethnic cleansing of Zionism and the desperate acts of Israel's premier Netanyahu to retain power. David, it seems to me that for some time the Zionists have had sympathy for most of the world, sympathy as the victims of the Nazis, their gas chambers, the Holocaust, and the search for the people who went to Israel, sometimes because it was their only place in the world that would accept them, their search for safety and security. But now creating this vicious cycle and ethnic cleansing on the way to the genocide, they've become the oppressor. I wonder, David, could that eventuate in international pressure for a two-state solution or maybe a binational state?
Well, the short answer as far as a binational solution is that the Hamas attack of October 7th and the war that Israel is now waging have actually set back any such possibility for a very long time. I mean, that's just the reality. Hamas's murderous attack of October 7th created a wave of sympathy for Israel in many parts of the world. And then within a week, Israel's siege and war in Gaza had turned that to revulsion. There is widespread revulsion in the world, and particularly in the Arab and Middle Eastern countries, to what Israel is doing. Does that put pressure on Israel? Well, it puts pressure on some of those governments, in particular what has been the centerpiece of American policy, which is to broker the normalization of relations between Israel and Saudi Arabia and then the other Gulf states, UAE, Qatar, etc. The U.S. plan has been that you create normalization between Israel and the Arab regimes, and then Palestine fades into irrelevance. And whatever happens to it doesn't have to really concern American policy very much. That, of course, has now been blown up. But pressure on Israel, meaningful pressure on Israel, can only come from one place, and that's the American government. And while you see the U.S. government pleading with Israel for a humanitarian pause, so-called, which means nothing, the U.S. government refuses, despite growing international pressure and despite growing domestic pressure, as you see from all of these huge demonstrations that are going on, the United States government refuses to call for a ceasefire. So in that respect, there isn't meaningful pressure on Israel. Now, among the populations of many countries, there's enormous sympathy for the Palestinians. And I would say, actually, my guess is that there is one country in the Middle East where there is popular sympathy for Israel, and that would be Iran, because the Iranian government is at war, of course, with its own population, and therefore Iran's blood-curdling but basically meaningless anti-Israel rhetoric will make many Iranians sympathetic to Israel. But other than that, yes, there is popular revulsion against Israel around the world, which is going to produce various blowbacks, including it's partly responsible for the rise in anti-Semitism in many places, as people identify the Israeli state with the Jewish people, as false as that equation is. But pressure on Israel for a binational solution, not in our lifetime, barring some miracle.
David, let's shift to discuss the force that will likely shape the future across the world. That is climate change, which is going to make life unlivable across the Middle East, among many other areas.
That is entirely true. When you look 50 years out, how much of the area is going to be habitable? How much of the U.S. South and Southwest is going to be habitable? That should be the lead story in the news every day in every part of the world, okay? But part of the current tragedy, of course, is that those issues which really threaten in an existential way the future of human civilization everywhere are buried.
Yeah, my sense is, I think I may steal the last word, that it's quite possible that if a series of climate catastrophes will wake up the popular classes all over the world to understand that the elites of the world have led them to a place where their lives and the lives of their children are threatened, and threatened deeply. And there may be movements, if they really get big and unstoppable, would be for working class movements to gain popular support for directing the mobilization of all resources to stop climate change You have to be lucky that, in fact, it's possible to stop it after concentrations get so high. That would then lead to, it seems to me, an international agreement that would change the position of all countries and lead to something approaching a democratic socialist solution. Anyway, it's amazing that we can talk about these things and not be seen as nuts. But there you have it. Dave, you get the last word. Thanks a lot for talking to us.
Okay, well, thanks very much. And I guess my appeal would be, wherever you are, whatever you can do, get into the streets to demand an immediate ceasefire. That doesn't address fundamental problems, which we can't solve on our own. But it is essential to raise the temperature to demand an immediate ceasefire, because there are already over 10,000 deaths, and in the next week, it'll be 20,000. So it is absolutely essential to foreground that demand right now, right here. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for talking to us today, Dave. We've run out of time.
Okay.
That's all, folks. David Finkel and I, we conversed on the history of Israel taking over lands previously inhabited by Palestinians, and the development of a vicious cycle of dispossession and repression, then resistance, with Hamas's recent senseless and savage attack, and the even more savage Israeli response with bombardment from the air, killing in here 20,000 Palestinians and apparently not stopping, and over 6,000 children. We need now work in this country on which Israel depends for this country to join with nearly all the rest of the world to demand Israel that it agree to a ceasefire and start of international negotiations that would ultimately maneuver for a peaceful solution that Israel might not like very much, but have to be get the consolation of creating a relatively peaceful Middle East. Thanks for talking to us today, Dave.
Okay. Thanks.
Nation is ready for a fight. Custer, I think it's gonna be your time. We got a whole lot of Indians, and Custer, I ain't lying.
You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland, your volunteer-powered, member-supported, non-commercial community radio station. I'm your host today, Fran Michelle, and we just heard some music from Blue Mountain Tribe performing Custer. The song was a winner at the Native American Music Awards and can be found on the CD Water is Life. Before that, we heard Bill Resnick talking with David Finkel about settler colonialism in the Middle East. You can find both parts of their conversation on the KBOO website. While you're there, you can click on the red Donate tab in the upper right corner of the page, or visit kboo.fm/give to become or continue to be one of our listener member supporters. The slogan, Water is Life, the title of that album from the Native American Music Awards, came to broad public awareness during the struggle at Standing Rock over the Dakota Access Pipeline, where thousands of indigenous people and allies tried to stop another treaty-violating and life-threatening bit of fossil fuel infrastructure, even in the face of violent repression from state and corporate forces. The pipeline was completed and has been operating since 2017, even though it had 5 reported leaks just in the first 6 months of operation. The pipeline runs under Lake Oahe, a source of drinking water, and within a half mile of the current boundaries of the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation, through land taken from the tribe by Congress in 1958. In 2020, a federal court ordered the Army Corps of Engineers to belatedly complete a full environmental impact statement. More than 3 years later, the draft of that statement is available for public comment until December 13th. You'll be able to find more information and a guide to commenting developed by the NDN Collective linked on the webpage for today's Old Mole episode. Next up, we turn to another dimension of settler colonial life and death, and entanglements of ideology, politics, and scientific inquiry. Jan Hocken talks with Cynthia Lou Coleman, Osage, Professor Emerita, Fulbright Chair, and author of Environmental Clashes on Native American Lands, about, among other things, the discovery and conflicts over the 9,000-year-old skeleton called Kennewick Man, and what we can learn from the story.
Welcome to KABU, Cynthia Lou Coleman.
Thank you, Jan.
Well, Dr. Coleman is Professor Emerita of Communications at Portland State University, a researcher in the fields of scientific discourse, environmental policies, and their impacts on North American indigenous peoples, and author of Environmental Clashes on Native American Lands. She is also an enrolled member of the Osage Nation. Well, thank you for joining me on the Old Mole Variety Hour this morning to talk about your recent very important book. But before taking up that work, can you say more about yourself and how you took up this topic of science and indigenous communities?
Thank you again for having me on. I think I would be disrespectful if I didn't introduce myself to your audience in our language, which we call Wajaje. So I would say to you, Hawe iye to akipshe kombre mitshida wita niagonska wajaje. Jaje wita, Cynthia Lou Coleman, eshtato to apasali. What I said is, if I hope it's okay if I say a few words in Osage. My name is Cynthia Lou Coleman. My indigenous name is Ishtatoto, and I'm from Pasoli, which is our word for gray horse. So that tells you a little bit of background. Obviously, you can tell that I'm Osage and learning the language, not very quickly, I'm afraid. And so what drew me to this sort of research is that I have a background in science communication and a background in environmental health and risk. And that's really what's driven my communication career for years and years. And I really could never not study Native issues. And by that, I don't mean the anthropological view of studying Native American people, but rather, how is it that they use their lens on the world to figure out how to live? And so what attracted me to that were the environmental struggles, or their scientific struggles, or their risk struggles, or their medical struggles that Native people have come up against, that they've confronted, where, in my view, it's not a symmetrical relationship, meaning that typically it's because something is being forced on them, or their opinions have been taken for granted.
Well, your book provides a fascinating and deep analysis of the Kennewick Man case study in science, racism, and indigenous knowledge. And I'd love to have you talk about this case of the 9,000-year-old skeleton that was found in the Columbia River area of Washington near Kennewick, Washington. And maybe talk about what was at stake in a very bitter and sustained conflict over the claims to these skeletal remains.
It went on a long, long time, more than 20 years, and this body was discovered by accident in 1995 in the Columbia River. And what happened was there were a couple of lads who were crossing the river. Somebody stepped on what they thought was a rock. It turned out to be a human skull. And they sort of debated, what do we do about this? And ended up taking it to the city of Kennewick, where, you know, bunches of people got together and said, boy, we should kind of figure out what this skull is. And wouldn't you know it, there is a freelance anthropologist who lived nearby, who had helped them in other cases. And his name is James Chatters. He came in And he said, you know, this skull doesn't look like a pioneer. It looks a bit older than that. So the story goes that they returned to the Columbia River. They extracted what is almost a complete skeleton and kept it in Kennewick and waited for a piece of the bone to be studied and carbon dated so they could figure out how old it was. And originally they figured the skeleton was anywhere between 7,000 and 10,000 years old. So that's an interesting story all in itself, right? So this discovery in 1995. Concurrently, the native tribes were not, at least from the first go, they weren't involved in any of this decision making. And what folks may not know is that there was a law signed, a federal law that was signed in 1990 that said, if you find human remains or if you find funereal objects or anything that looks like it could be Native American that's located on land that's not private, you have to notify the local tribes or and at least get in touch with people that can help you broker information with the tribes. And that wasn't done, you know, according to folks like Armand Minthorn, who became a spokesperson for the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla. So it began sort of on bad footing. I'm not saying that would predict the outcome, but the native folks said, you know, this is probably one of our ancestors if it's that old. And there's a law that says it needs to be returned, not just protected, but repatriated to the tribes.
That's the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act.
That's right. And so it's actually been around. Now we look back and say for a long time, I think from the indigenous point of view, it wasn't enacted early enough. 1990 is pretty late in terms of Native American, how would you say, provenance over their over our own bodies and our own artifacts.
That act itself came out of tremendous pain and deep history of violations of Aboriginal ancestors.
I don't want to get too distracted from your question, but that's really part of what the book is about too, is sort of the legacy of, you know, not just Indigenous people, but folks that were considered primitive in some regard. It's called race science by people that think that it has the study of human individuals has been led a lot by belief systems as opposed to, you know, sort of what we would consider scientific information. And it's a bit wonky in the sense that in the 1800s, a scientific method rose that they called phrenology. And what phrenology means is the study of the brain or the study of the mind. And basically it divided humans, you know, Homo sapiens into between 5 and 8 different categories. And if I said them to you out loud, they would be quite disrespectful to the people that they refer to. And so if it's okay with you, I can tell you what how the phrenologists framed that, and that is that the most powerful, important, beautiful, smartest, elegant human people are the Caucasians, and they're right at the top, right? And then below that, they stack people that they call Orientals, that they call Ethiopians, referring to anybody from Africa. They also have a group of people that would be considered in a different sort of Eastern category, and then the Native Americans, who they simply called Americans, you know.
This is part of your larger argument about racial hierarchies and racial ideologies driving practices of science that are considered empirical and are sometimes contrasted with the spiritual ethos of Native practices. There is this a whole set of mythologies and ideological interests guiding the history of science, including how this came to bear on approaches to skeletal remains.
Exactly. And I don't think it would be a surprise if I told you that a lot of these assumptions had to do with also scientists understanding that Native Americans, but other folks as well, could not change, right? So look at what has happened, they would say. We've educated them, we've shown them railroads, we've shown them how to do things properly, and they just won't learn. And so it's a misinterpretation of an inability to be civilized. And that's, you know, that's what a lot of settlers considered Native people to be. Not just uncivilized, but not civilizable. But what that does is it enables you to say, well, you know, if we can't change them, we're just going to have to kill them off, or, you know, reduce their bloodline so much that they're going to be real Americans. You know, take the Indian out of the person.
Right, and that has a very bitter, violent history attached to it.
So the scientific method, I think, is very, very clear in terms of, you know, saying you don't want to have bias, you don't have, you know, sort of interpretation from your belief systems. And you know what? We're human beings. We all are subject to that. So, you know, science is not as clean as we pretend, nor is it something that should prevail over every single issue to say this is really the ultimate way of looking at this. So, you know, if I were speaking, and I cannot speak for all Indigenous people, I don't mean to do that, but to speak from a view that is more open-minded to Indigenous points of view, it would be, you know, well, how do they know what they know? And it's not just empirical, you know, because it would be silly to say Native people aren't scientific. Of course we are. Have you seen, you know, the camas that grows in Oregon? You know, that was so important to the Native people. Does it have a sacred component? Of course it does. But guess what? It's not separate from the scientific. You know, it's all seen within one picture. So if a Native person were to say, you know, These are sacred, that's not a part. It's not distinguished from science. And a lot of tribes don't have a word for science, you know, but they don't have a word for, you know, the white God either. So they have words for relationships that we have with our surroundings.
And that there's a material grounding to that spirituality. It's not only about a remote father god, but very much grounded in observations and survival in the world around us, and rich practices that have shifted over time, and observations that inform much of our understanding now of the climate crisis, if we're to pay attention.
Exactly.
But with the Kennewick man, you're saying part of how your interest was over time, how this was framed in public discourse between science and superstition or spirituality. Can you continue with the story and say how it was resolved on either grounds? What was the denouement to this story? And was it one you felt was satisfying?
That's a really good question, because we didn't know for so long. I've been studying this since 1995. It really took a course that I would not have predicted. And that is that there was a crew of Danish scientists that also got permission to take a look at a piece of bone. And it took a long time for them to try to figure out whether there was a relationship with local tribal people. So the Confederated Tribe of the Cowlitz, or the Colville, excuse me, agreed to give them saliva so that they could look at DNA, but it took a long time. And in the final analysis, what they did was they published a piece in Nature that said, guess what? Kennewick man is a relative to Indigenous people in California, in Oregon and Washington. What was interesting to me in reading that story is reading their publication, was that they also said that the way that the anthropologists went through talking about whether this skull was Native American or a pioneer was phrenological at best, meaning they weren't making scientific judgments. They were making judgments based on their beliefs about what a skull should look like.
So there is an irreducible ambiguity around the appropriate test for Kennewick man. And you're saying part of what was important at that point for the tribes in this region was the approach based on respect and a deep attentiveness to the different ways people were approaching Kennewick Man. It's a process that was based on respect, which was lacking from the start.
And there are cases where Native people have worked with scientists all over the place, right? In terms of, just think of, you know, all the work that CRTFIC, the Columbia River Intertribal Fish Council, does with, you know, their own biologists who are also Native people. Native people are not anti-science, right? So that's really a mistake that we get from the coverage of that. And then just to answer sort of your question about, well, then what happened? Well, after this, you know, sort of this important publication explaining that they found this connection with DNA, Patty Murray, who's a legislator in Washington, asked President Obama to return the skeletal remains to the Native tribes. It took, I think, a year and a half for that to happen, but it did. And so the Native people did not invite the press. They did not invite people who had a vested interest, and they buried respectfully the ancient one that they call him. And we don't know where it is. And sometimes you just don't know. And that's okay.
And maybe that's a commentary itself on the hubris of Western science that rejects ambiguity and uncertainty. And that's where many of these horrible decisions with long-term consequences supported by science that are part of industries and practices that have been so destructive to Indigenous peoples come out of that kind of short-sighted idea and the hubris of orienting science toward conquering and controlling nature. So there are many, many other interesting insights, cautionary tales in your book. It's a great read. I love the book, even though it's clearly written by an academic. It's accessible, and the Kennewick Man story, you know, the way you unpack it and its manifold lessons, I think, are so important.
Thank you. Yeah. And I hope this doesn't sound terribly like an advertising pitch, but the way that the publisher who set it up, you can actually, you know, buy a chapter if you want. You don't have to buy the whole book. And
that's interesting that it's available in sections or chapters. Say the title again and where listeners can get it.
Sure. The name of it is Environmental Clashes on Native American Land. The publisher is Palgrave, and that's www.palgrave.com. And also I've ordered it for any library that would, you know, order it for me. So
I very much appreciate your promoting worlds beyond Amazon that has devoured so exactly. much of our culture, including literature. Well, thank you so much, Cynthia Luke Coleman, for being with us today on the Old Mole Variety Hour, and I hope you can join us again.
Thank you, Jan, Dr. Hackin. It's been my pleasure. I appreciate it.
Can you hear our voices? We are one.
That was Spirit Cry from Idle No More on the Native American Music Award NAMA 16 Winners Album. Before that, we heard Jan Hocken talking with Cynthia Lou Coleman about lessons from the story of finding ancient human remains near Kennewick, Washington. You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm your host today, Fran Michelle. As always, you'll be able to find this show, both audio and additional links, at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. And you can support KBOO and the Mole by clicking on the red Donate tab in the upper right corner. Finally, in today's explorations of our unequal struggles for justice, we look at how capitalist interests have tried to squelch the fight for quality public education in Portland and in Oregon. Guest mole Alyssa Vitale helps us recognize some of those working against the interests of teachers, students, and communities.
This month, for the first time in city history, Portland teachers went on strike. While students, families, and community members turned out in droves to support teachers at the picket line, local capitalists reared up, aiming to shame the teachers' union into submission. In October, Portland Metro Chamber published an open letter urging the teachers' union and school administrators to avoid a strike. Portland Metro Chamber, aka Portland Business Alliance, is a regional association that advocates for the capitalist class. While it claims to speak for all sorts of businesses, Portland Metro Chamber's decision makers are far from local mom-and-pop shops. Its board is full of multinational corporations, commercial real estate companies, banks, and corporate law firms. The board has also represented local real estate dynasties like the Schnitzers, the Goodmans, and the Sturgeons. Portland Metro Chamber's lobbying efforts are prolific. Over the past decade, they lobbied city officials 7 times more than any other organization. The chamber also has close ties to Oregon Business and Industry, a state-level lobbying group. Together, they pressure electeds to keep business and wealth taxes low at the expense of working people. But back to their open letter. Between a bevy of union-busting talking points, Portland Metro Chamber waxed poetic about their longtime generous support for education funding. Their chief example was the 2019 Student Success Act, which imposed a statewide business tax to fund education. The open letter conveniently omits that Portland Metro Chamber and Oregon Business and Industry stopped opposing the Student Success Act only after they manipulated the tax language to their liking. Behind closed doors, lobbyists twisted the tax in ways that make it easier for businesses to pass on the cost to consumers. They also wormed in a local preemption, which means no city, county, or district in Oregon can create its own commercial activity tax. This language was forced into the Student Success Act less than 6 months after voters established the Portland Clean Energy Fund, or PCEF, a local initiative that funds climate justice efforts through a tax on the biggest corporations and the biggest polluters. Since PCEF launched, Portland Metro Chamber has repeatedly attacked the program and lobbied to reallocate its revenue to unrelated projects. One key lobbyist behind Student Success Act business safeguards was Julia Brim Edwards. Today, Brim Edwards is a Multnomah County Commissioner and a Portland Public Schools board member. But her roots lie firmly in capital. In 2019, Brim Edwards was a Nike executive and a Portland Metro Chamber board member. A year earlier, she helped block a ballot measure that would have forced Oregon corporations to publicly disclose tax information. Her Herculean efforts to protect corporations have won many friends. She was the top honoree at Portland Metro Chamber's 2023 gala, and a who's who of Portland business has contributed the maximum individual donation to her political action committee, including Jordan Schnitzer, Vanessa Sturgeon, Mark Schlesinger, and 5 members of the Goodman family. Besides the Student Success Act, Portland Metro Chamber and its allies have spent the past 4 years attacking equitable education funding locally, specifically Multnomah County's Universal Preschool Program, Preschool for All. Attacks on Preschool for All started even before the program existed. In 2019, the Universal Preschool Now Coalition filed paperwork to run a ballot measure that would fund preschool for all 3- and 4-year-olds in the county through a tax on high-income households. In response, Portland Metro Chamber lobbyist John Isaacs filed 2 unsuccessful legal challenges aiming to prevent the measure from reaching voters. Ultimately, the campaign made it to the ballot and won, almost 2-1. Despite this overwhelming support, Portland Metro Chamber members continue to attack Preschool for All. For example, board member emeritus Patrick Gilligan, executive vice president of an international real estate firm, spent several minutes on stage at a revitalized Portland Coalition summit whining about the modest tax. The chamber's media members have also taken up the charge. Willamette Week recently ran a series of stories framing the program's living wages for preschool teachers as a problem. As an aside, one of Portland Metro Chamber's bronze level members is the for-profit childcare corporation KinderCare, which generated over $1 billion in revenue in 2020. Who could imagine why they might oppose a robust public preschool program? Teachers at all levels, preschool, K-12, and beyond, are essential to positive student outcomes, which impact our entire community. Teachers' working conditions are student learning conditions, and research shows that class size, school facilities, and high-quality teachers all significantly impact student learning. Investments in the well-being of our students and our educators are an investment in all of us. And we do have resources to adequately fund our schools, despite what Portland Metro Chamber wants you to think. Revenue from the PSEF and preschool taxes was substantially higher than projected. That does not mean taxes are too high. Rather, it illustrates gross inequality in Oregon. While our students shiver in moldy, rat-infested schools, the wealthy Scrooge McDucks hoard their coins. Speaking of ducks, did you know that lauded University of Oregon philanthropist Phil Knight, as one individual, owns more wealth than the bottom half of all Oregonians combined? Instead of allowing Oregon millionaires to rack up accolades and tax credits for donating to their pet programs, imagine how many schools we could fully fund by taxing their wealth. On the picket line, Portland teachers warned that the issues they face are not unique to Portland classrooms. Schools across Oregon are plagued by inadequate resources and outdated infrastructure. We will not solve the deliberate systemic underfunding of our public schools by relying on capitalists and the politicians they buy to dribble out funds. We cannot afford to allow corporate electeds like Julia Brim Edwards to shield businesses at the expense of our teachers and our students. We must make bold investments in our people, especially workers like teachers who make our communities run. To do that, we must demand that the wealthy few who extract our labor and would collapse without us pay their fair share.
To reach his own, be the change, set the tone. One day you might even never make it home. So live now, I'm on it. I'll never back down when I'm in the moment. Take the reins and bite down. It's a mind state and a lifestyle. My growth depends on my choosing. I make mistakes, but I'm human. You can slow me down, but never hold me down. I'll be 6 underground when you stop my movement.
That was Just James performing Break These Chains from the NAMA Live 19 Winners compilation. Before that, you heard Alyssa Vitale explaining how the Portland Metro Chamber of Commerce, part of the Portland Business Alliance, along with other Oregon business lobbyists and corporate politicians, protect capitalist interests at the expense of the rest of us. You have been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland, your volunteer-powered, member-supported, non-commercial community radio station. As always, you can find the whole show and its segments, with additional links and information, at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour, where you can listen again, subscribe, share, and join KBOO by clicking on the red Donate tab in the upper right corner of the page. Remember that KBOO is a nonprofit, non-commercial, listener-sponsored community radio station. 80% of KBOO's funding comes from listeners, and we cannot do this without you. I'm Fran Michel. I've been your host for this episode, and I could not do this without everyone else at KBOO, and especially the other volunteers and guests on today's show. Many thanks to Bill Resnick and his guest, David Finkel, for their discussion of Israel and Palestine. Thanks to Jan Hocken and her guest, Cynthia Lou Coleman, for their discussion of Professor Coleman's book, Environmental Clashes on Native American Land. And thanks to guest mole Alyssa Vitale for her illumination of some of the who, how, and why of business interests and their lobbyists in Portland trying to shape education and tax policy. Thanks to John Nelson and Patricia Kullberg for editing. Thanks to Joe Clement for performing our theme song. Thanks to all the staff, volunteers, and listener members of KBOO. The Old Mole will be back next Monday with more news, views, reviews, and interviews from the Mole's ground roots perspective.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
This month, besides being the season of Thanksgiving, here at KBOO we celebrate Native American heritage. Tune in throughout the rest of the month for special programming hosted and produced by Native American creators, as well as programming highlighting Native American, First Nation, Indigenous, and Aboriginal cultures here on KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland.
Dr. Zom's Stereo Obscura. Offbeat sounds for talented listeners. Broadcasts every other Wednesday at